tonight, and I think Brother Pat made mention of that. It was to my surprise that I would not have thought that the three individuals that we only have eight verses dealing with, that there was all that much to be thought about, but that's the way sometimes these character studies work. So we're studying tonight Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And we see that they were the three sons of Noah, who along with their wives accompanied Noah and his wife in the ark during the flood. We see from Genesis 5, verse 32, Brother Philip, read this, that verse.
Shem, Ham, and Japheth were the three sons of Noah. That's what I did. Okay. Noah was 500 years old, and named God Shem,
Ham, and Japheth. Oh, sorry about that. But Noah was 500 years old when he began to have children, and it was their descendants, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, it was their descendants that went out to repopulate the world. But it reads Genesis 9:18.
These three were sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated.
From these the whole earth was populated. And then look at chapter 10 and verse 1, Brother Don.
Sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and sons were born to them after the flood.
All right. So we see that sons were born to these three after the flood. And certainly if Noah had any other children, we just simply are unable to find any mention made of them in the scriptures. But all of the human race that exists today can trace their lineage back to one of these three brothers. And I find that rather remarkable. The Israelites came from the line of Shem. In fact, that word Semite that we hear used even today, it comes from the name of Shem. The other descendants of Shem include the Assyrians, the Chaldeans, the Elamites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, and the Edomites. And we are familiar with these nations as we go through the history of the children of Israel. Ham's lineage produced the Canaanites. And along with that, the Babylonians, the Phoenicians, the Cushites, and the Egyptians. And it was Japheth's lineage that produced the Persians, the Romans, the Scythians, and the Macedonians. Now, if there's a preliminary lesson to the study of these three boys, it, I believe, would have to be this. You know, we tend to categorize people by their skin color, their language, maybe the color of their eyes, color of their hair. And yet these superficial distinctions are the very basis for our division of mankind. And sometimes it's the only basis that we think in terms of. You know, we speak of the white race, the yellow race, the black race, and so forth and so on. But, you know, it's here in this passage that we should learn there is only one race, the human race. As we've seen, even reminding ourselves of really, we know that all of mankind comes through these three boys. Well, go back a few years earlier and they all come through Adam and Eve. And I think it was maybe Brother Byron last Wednesday night that made mention of the fact that Eve was the mother of all living. So we've seen that we all have the common ancestry of Adam and Eve. And now we're seeing, even though the world populated and yet God destroyed it with the flood that we studied last week, Now we see that all people that exist today have come from one of these three men, these three brothers. And so, there are three families of mankind. Chapter 10, if you go in and look at it and read it, it goes on to trace the spread of these families headed by Shem, Ham, and Jasper. And we learn to which division that mankind, each of us, belongs to. And it's here in chapter 9 that we're focusing our study tonight that we learn the distinctive contribution that each family group is intended to make to the human race. And each contribution is different, it's unique. It can be demonstrated in society that this is why God has divided the race into three families. And, you know, really thinking about it, this is something that sociologists have lost sight of. And therefore, many of their ideas, many of their concepts about society are false. So we need very much to return to an understanding of what these verses are teaching us. So let's consider this. Normally, the way things that are listed in the scriptures is very important. But look what we have in verse 22 and verse 24. Jeremy?
And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. So Noah woke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done.
So we see here in these two verses who is the younger of these three. It says that Ham was the one that saw the nakedness of his father, and when Noah woke and knew what the younger son had done. So Ham is the youngest. Now, in the normal Hebrew listing of the names of a man's sons, they would be given in chronological order, beginning with the oldest, the eldest of the children. But in this particular case, it seems that Jephthah was the oldest. And so the order, as far as chronological order, would be Jephthah, Shem, and Ham, Ham being the youngest. And yet the remarkable thing is that every time that these three sons are referred to in the scriptures together, that's the order they're in, Shem, Ham, and Jephthah. And notice also in verse 22 that we read there, we're told that Ham was the father of Canaan. And by making mention of Canaan, I believe we have sort of, in a way, a spotlight being turned on concerning a very highly significant event in the life of Ham, an incident which has impact upon the entire story found in the Old Testament, because I'm sure we're familiar with the Canaanites that were, of course, possessors of the land of Canaan before it was that Moses led the children of Israel out of Egyptian bondage. So, there's only one account recorded in the scriptures that concerns Shem, Ham, and Jephthah. And they're found in Genesis 9, verses 20 through 27. Let's read those together. Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard. Then he drank of the wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Jephthah took a garment, laid it on both of their shoulders, and went backwards and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. So Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him. Then he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants, he shall be to his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Jephthah, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant." What I want to do is to, and these are not necessarily lessons, but I want to look at four things that we need to know, or four things that we need to give consideration to, that comes from these eight verses that we just read. The first thing I want us to, of course, and obviously we would give consideration to, is the fact of Noah's drunkenness. This event had to have taken place a considerable time after Noah and his family left the ark. Because, just think about it, there had to be time for Noah to plant a vineyard. And starting from scratch, we might say, he would have had to have taken time to allow that vineyard to grow to the point where it would produce fruit. And it's my understanding from what I've read that it would take generally somewhere between 3 to 5 years for a vine, a grapevine, once it started to grow to the point where it would begin to start producing grapes. So we're looking at 3 to 5 years there. There, of course, had to be time for the harvest of the grapes, time to gather the grapes, time to extract the grape or the juice from the grapes, time to allow it to ferment into wine, and then time for Noah to drink the wine and to become drunk. So let's realize that there's been a passing of a few years from the time that Noah and his family come off the ark until we read about this particular event here in verses 20 through 27 of Genesis 9. It's difficult to know what to make of the drunkenness of Noah. And what I mean by that is that there are some who suggest that it means that fermentation had never occurred before on the earth. Well, that's an idea, something maybe to give consideration to, maybe something that has some truth. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Roger. And so, if that's the case, Noah would not have known what was going to happen to him when he drank so much wine. And so this might explain his drunkenness. And two, when you think about it, it might have been well indeed an act of innocence, rather than an act of self-indulgence. You know, to think about it, we don't read of any blame, rebuke, anything that was given to Noah, even though afterwards we know that drunkenness is everywhere condemned in the scriptures, and it's clearly identified as sin, contrary to God's will. And evidently, we see Noah felt warm because of the effects of alcohol. He took off his clothes, he fell asleep in his tent, or as you know, sometimes we would say of a drunken person that he passed out, and he laid exposed in the tent. The second thing I want us to give consideration to is the strange act of Ham. Just exactly what did Ham do? Well, that's difficult to determine. There are those who connect this episode with the account in Leviticus chapter 18, where under the law of Moses, this phrase, to see nakedness, see the nakedness of an individual, was a euphemism. I'm sure we know what a euphemism is. It's a milder word that used to refer to some more vivid or descriptive thing. So it could be that this is what they're saying, that in Leviticus 18, to see the nakedness of an individual is referring to a sexual act. There are others who feel that this involved a more perverted act on the part of Ham. And I'm not going to go any further than just what I've said. If someone else wants to make comment and take it further, you certainly can do so. But as for me, I'm just not going there. This may have been true. But I'm in favor of taking the lesser of the two. It's clear. Ham looked upon his father's nakedness. There's no question about that. So, the most likely answer to the question of what did Ham do is that he looked upon his father's nakedness either with lust or with delight and amusement. Because, see, he went and he told his brothers, not in the spirit of being troubled, not in the spirit of being concerned for Noah, but possibly more with that attitude of, hey guys, you want to come see something? It's the idea that his flippancy, and what I mean by flippancy here is his disrespect. Also, it carries the idea with it that it's a lack of seriousness. So his flippancy toward his father's nakedness, I think, reveals two things about him. One is he had no shame. He had no grief concerning morals. But see, all we got to do is go back to Genesis 3. Well, in Genesis 2, the Bible said that when God presented Eve to Adam, and Adam said, this is now bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, you should be called woman. He goes on and says, a man will leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. And the next verse says that Adam and Eve were naked and were not ashamed. But then in chapter 3, when sin enters the picture, God comes walking in the cool of the evening in the garden, and Adam and Eve hide themselves. And God says, where are you? And Adam said, we were afraid. Is it that they had never heard God's voice before? Obviously they had. The idea is that they were now ashamed. So, what Leviticus 18 applies to Shem, Ham, and Japheth, or this principle of shame, as is always applied to nakedness in the scriptures. Ham simply showed disrespect for his father, whose honor he was quick to trample on. And maybe, To better our understanding of this incident, let's recall the conditions that existed before the flood. And what was the cause of the flood? Rodney read us Genesis 6, verses 5 and 12.
Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, and all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth.
Noah's son grew up in this kind of an environment. And in view of all of this, it could very well have been that Ham regarded this whole matter of his father's nakedness very lightly. If that's the case, I think there's a whole lot of Ham's attitude in our society today, and in far too many Christians, that there is no shame that's felt concerning nudity or even near nudity. It's treated very flippantly, very lightly. And the third thing for us to consider is the respect that's shown by Shem and Japheth. Whatever the extent of Ham's sin, whatever it was, Shem and Japheth refused to join him in dishonoring their father. So instead, they walked into the tent backward without looking at Noah, and they covered him. We read that in verse 23. And then Noah blessed the other two sons while repeating Canaan's servitude to both Shem and Japheth. We read that in verses 26 and 27. And the fourth thing is to consider the cursing of Canaan. Think about this. This is Noah's grandson, the son of Ham. Noah curses Canaan in the place of Ham. And that we read in verses 25 through 27. Why does Noah curse Canaan instead of Ham? Well, could it be that Noah knew a great deal about human nature that most people don't today? You know, Noah evidently recognized the link involving the influence of the parent, the influence of one generation upon another. And another possibility is that Noah is acting under divine wisdom when he selects one out of the four sons of Ham to pronounce this curse. Ham has four sons, and yet Canaan is the one that Noah curses. You know, was this a part that God played in? We don't know. But neither do we know why, an exact reason, that Noah curses Canaan. And again, whatever the reason, let's remember, God understands us better than we understand ourselves. No doubt the one area in which we consistently fail, and maybe not so much fail, maybe it's that we just consistently minimize, is to understand, to recognize the link between parents and children. Whatever Ham did, he did because of his tolerance, what it allowed him to do. And yet, in his son, it would be greatly intensified. Now, what I mean by that is just this statement. There is much truth to the statement that whatever one generation tolerates, the next generation will embrace. So therefore the curse rested upon Canaan, regardless of our thinking, as far as to why. But certainly these are four things that I'm sure catches our attention and brings questions to our mind, and I'm not really sure that there is a clear-cut answer. So what are the lessons that we can learn from all of this? Well, even the most godly people are prone to sin. See, no matter how long that we've been a Christian, we never build an immunity against sin. But the pack read is 1 Corinthians 10:12. Think about Noah. He was the most righteous man of his day. Yet he got drunk. And he laid naked in his tent. Whether it was innocence, not knowing what fermentation would do, or why, whatever the reason, we do know that Noah was the most righteous man in his day. We studied that last week. Noah found favor in the eyes of God. Noah found grace in the eyes of God. But this should help us to see that past godliness doesn't guarantee future godliness. You know, let this also teach us that we're often the most vulnerable when the pressure is off. What I mean by that, when the pressure is off, that's when we put our guard down. And those that live righteously before God know their likelihood to sin, and so they live in constant dependence upon the Lord for strength that comes only from His Word. And another lesson, we can all easily become callous towards sin. You know those eight verses that we read? When you read those verses, whether tonight was the first time or whether you studied some before tonight, when you read those eight verses, what did you think? Really, what did you think? What was your thinking when you read those verses? And you read about Noah's drunkenness and about what Ham does particularly. What would you think? You'd just say, well, what's the big deal? Ham just looks on his father's nakedness. And that curse seems to be a bit extreme, not to mention unfair. Could it be that those were some of the fleeting thoughts that went through your mind as you read those eight verses? If you did, do we not see it's this attitude that reveals our own callousness towards sin? You know, we're so used to moral filth that's dumped into our living rooms every night through the TV that we don't even know it when we see it. And, you know, I'm just not talking about language. I'm talking about dress or lack of dress, violence. And even worse, we find humor in it when we should be horrified by it. A man that painted houses said that after a few hours, he never spilt the paint anymore. Well, I think there's something spiritual there too. And that is, when we're surrounded and surround ourselves by the stench of sin after a while, we just don't notice it. The only way for us to be more sensitive to sin is to spend more time in God's Word and to avoid exposing ourselves needlessly to the evil that's around us. Romans 16 and verse 9. Brother Davis.
For your obedience is known to all, so that I rejoice over you, but I want you to be wise as to what is good and innocent as to what is evil.
All right. And another lesson. And we don't have all that much time to comment, but sins that don't seem big at the time, they can have far-reaching consequences, not only for ourselves, but for our descendants. Yes?
Brother Paul, before you finish, I wanted to make a comment. You said something about past godliness does not predict or necessarily guarantee future godliness. When I think about the curse and whether or not it was fair or unfair, I'm reminded of Rahab, who lived and dwelt in the land of Canaan. And I don't know if the scripture identifies, it doesn't come to my mind, whether she was actually of Canaanite or Canaan descendancy. But she's proof that though the trend might have been this way, we each can decide our own fate. So past wickedness does not necessarily dictate future wickedness.
No.
And we realize that through her came the Christ.
That's a good point. Good point. Another lesson. Be careful not to allow a family member's sin to trigger us to sin. And of course, that's the good example that Shem and Japheth were. They could just as easily join in with Ham, to whatever extent it was, in the dishonoring, which would have been what it would have boiled down to, regardless of what particular thing it may have been, it still boils down to disrespect, dishonor, a lack of seriousness about a situation that needed to be dealt with far more differently than what Ham was doing. But those two brothers, they did not join in. And yet, that is an area where Satan does do a lot of his tempting, is through other family members, through what they do. That seems to give people, if it doesn't give them permission, it at least gives them justification in their own minds for doing whatever it is they do. And two,
Brother Paul,
yes.
I want to make one more comment. Talking about the nakedness. There's a serious problem with the understanding of what is nakedness today. And going to John chapter 21, verse 7. Now, this is Peter out in the boat fishing. And I'll pick up with this, and it says in verse 7, therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved said unto Peter, it is the Lord. Now he didn't know anybody was coming. When Simon Peter heard it, that it was the Lord, he girt his fisher's coat unto him. And in parentheses, and it says, for he was naked. Now some people think you've got to have all your clothes. No, you don't. He took his fisher's coat off. Still had clothing on, but was considered naked. And he jumped into the sea. Mm-hmm. We don't need to take our clothes off, period.
No.
Because here he was naked. How much more so all of your clothes? He was still clothed.
No.
But the scriptures here, he was naked.
No.
And even with that, he still put a coat on and jumped into the sea to keep the Lord from seeing him.
And that's a point that goes back even to Adam and Eve, that when they saw they were naked, they sewed fig leaves together. And yet, when the Lord came, you know.
It's a serious problem. Serious.
Yeah.
It's just a serious problem.
Well, it is. That's right. Absolutely. And another lesson is, Bell one, right. It is important to honor our parents, even when they fail. That's still a responsibility that we owe to our parents. Not that we condone them, not that we uphold them, but still, as parents to children, we respect them. We would honor them. We would rebuke them. We would try to convince them of whatever the sin or the error is in their life, but still, they are deserving of our respect. And another lesson is obvious. Beware of the dangers of alcohol. Like we said, whether fermentation was something that was ever even known about, or whether it was, whether Noah did this out of innocence, or whether he did it out of self-gratification. What we see from this point forward and every mention made in the scriptures in both the Old and the New Testament, drunkenness is always condemned. Drunkenness is always a sin. It has no part, no place in the life of a child of God, whether under the law of Moses or a Christian under the law of Christ. In conclusion, the bottom line for each of us is, though we are prone to sin, we can obey the Lord and experience His blessings. Ask yourself, do I want God's blessings in my life for my children, for my grandchildren? I don't think there's anyone in this audience that would answer no to that. Certainly we all would say yes. Well, the way that we experience God's blessings is through obedience to Him. So if we want God's blessings for ourselves, our children, and our grandchildren, we've got to get serious about obedience. And we've got to get tough on our sins. My brother Glenn said, it's not flippant. It's not something to be treated lightly. This is serious, our soul. It may or may not cause us problems here in this world. But one place for sure is that in the judgment, we will have to come to terms with it. And in eternity is where the consequences of it will be seen. So, lesson 6 in our series, the next person that we come to is that of a very notable man and wife, husband and wife, and that is of Abraham and Sarah. Appreciate the comments. Appreciate your attention, and certainly turn over the services when I'm not sure who does the invitation this evening, but we'll